Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
One in six U.S. election officials have experienced threats because of their job, and 77% say that they feel these threats have increased in recent years. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written jointly by Ruby Edlin and Turquoise Baker writers. This article is published under the heading Poll of U.S. Local Election Officials Find Safety Fears for Colleagues and Themselves. Stay tuned for more. As American democracy finds itself under assault from claims about the 2020 presidential race being stolen, election officials are a prime target in the attempt to undermine future elections. In 2020, in the face of a pandemic, record high turnout, and a flood of disinformation about the decision process and its integrity, these officials managed to run the most secure election in American history. But now, a new Brennan Center poll of local election officials around the country shows how damaging the sustained attacks against them and their colleagues have been, putting a political election administration and democratic system in serious danger. Here are some key findings from the survey. American election officials are facing threats, and safety concerns are in part why some have left their jobs. One in six election officials have experienced threats because of their job, and 77% say that they feel these threats have increased in recent years. Ranging from death threats that name officials' young children to racist and gendered harassment, these attacks have forced election officials across the country to take steps like hiring personal security, fleeing their homes, and putting their children into counseling. As election workers attempt to keep democracy afloat amidst these conditions, over half of polled respondents reported that they are concerned about the safety of their colleagues. More than one in four are concerned about being assaulted on the job. Understandably, some election workers have decided these threats are too high a risk. 30% of the officials in poll know of one or more election workers who have left, at least in part because of fear for their safety, increased threats, or intimidation. In the long term, 60% of officials are concerned that threats, harassment, and intimidation against local election officials will make it difficult to retain and recruit election workers. Election officials and staff have a heavy workload with a slew of tasks that must be regularly undertaken and expertise that must be developed. Combined with limited staff and resources, recruiting and retention challenges would further burden these offices. Most election officials like their jobs, with 3 in 4 agreeing that they find real enjoyment in their roles. However, 20% plan to leave before 2024 election, with 1/3 of those citing political leaders' attacks on a system they know is fair and honest as one of their top reasons for leaving. However, 20% plan to leave before the 2024 election, with 1/3 of those citing political leaders' attacks on a system as one of their top reasons for leaving, and nearly 1/3 cite unnecessary stress as one of their top reasons for leaving. U.S. election officials fear that conspiracy theories will infect administration and are worried about political interference. As conspiracy theories continue to grip a significant portion of the elect, over half of election officials are concerned that some incoming election officials might believe there was widespread voter fraud during the 2020 election. As election officials work hard to repeat the successes of the 2020 election, nearly 2/3 of them reported being worried about political leaders interfering in how they do their job in future elections. Since the 2020 vote, partisan actors have interfered with a political election administration as part of the broader election sabotage movement. For example, states have passed laws that allow partisans to seize control of election administration and criminally punish election officials for minor infractions. Further, nearly 1 in 5 local election officials in the United States are concerned about facing pressure to certify election results in favor of a specific candidate or party. Election officials are particularly unhappy with support provided by the federal government. Nearly 80% of federal officials think the federal government is either doing nothing to support them or taking some steps but not doing enough. While U.S. Congress has provided cash-strapped state and local election offices with some support in recent years, that has represented a fraction of what is all needed. Although they feel the most support at the local level, nearly 1/3 of local election officials still feel that their local government could be doing more to support them. The poll also shows that the U.S. Justice Department's Election Threats Task Force, which investigates and prosecutes threats against election officials, has to work to do when it comes to reaching election officials and local law enforcement. 90% of election officials never heard of or didn't know much about the task force. After hearing about it, 57% were somewhat or very confident that it would make them feel safer. It's clear that the Department of Justice should conduct more outreach to local election officials. It should also increase coordination with local law enforcement, who receive the majority of threat reports, according to the poll. Only a fraction of local election officials who have been threatened because of their job reported the threat to law enforcement, but 89% of those who did responded to local law enforcement. Social media is seen as a major contributor to problems. Over 3 in 4 local election officials think that social media companies haven't done enough to stop the spread of false information, and over 1 in 3 of those who experienced threats have been threatened over social media. Answering questions from voters who have been misled by inaccurate election information can be overwhelming and time-consuming, straining election officials and their staff. Social media companies should do more to promote accurate information over false information and work directly with election officials to address pressing concerns. These poll results should raise the alarm for anyone who cares about professional apolitical election administration, especially because they're coming from the people who know it best. All levels of government must act to protect elections and the people who run them.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Top diplomats from the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, Egypt, and the United States hold a summit in the Negev Desert. Foreign ministers of the Arab countries hold talks with Israeli officials to discuss bilateral relations. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken also took part in the Negev summit.
Israel is trying to achieve something that it basically has not achieved for most of its history. Namely, it is to gang up on the Palestinians and the Arab countries that support the Palestinians.
The controversial summit comes as Tel Aviv is pressing ahead with its expansionist policies, including settlement construction on occupied Palestinian territories. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas condemned the meeting. Hamas said the meeting is a symbol of cooperation with Israeli plots against Palestine and its people. Hamas reiterated its absolute rejection of all forms of normalization with the occupying regime, stressing that such meetings only serve the enemy in perpetuating its continuous aggression against our land, our people, and our holy sites. The resistance movement also called on the Arab countries that signed the Abraham Accords with Israel to reconsider their move to honor their historical responsibilities to protect Al-Quds. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad said on Sunday that the Negev summit reflects the loss of Arab identity of all those who agreed to be part of the enemy's normalization project. Meanwhile, the Deputy Secretary General of Bahrain's Al-Wafaq National Islamic Society also condemned the meeting, warning that the Bahraini regime was making a miscalculation. The UAE normalized ties with Israel in 2020 under U.S. brokered deals. Bahrain and Morocco followed suit, while Sudan also agreed to normalize ties with Israel. Also recently, the Saudi Crown Prince described Israel as a potential ally. The trend of normalization has been roundly condemned by Palestinians as a brazen betrayal of their cause. The normalization of ties with Israel, with a strong U.S. support, is widely considered as a betrayal of the Palestinian cause. However, despite opposition from Palestinians, the Arab countries seem to be obsessed with the economic benefits of establishing ties with Israel. They are getting close to the regime at the expense of the rights of the Palestinians. This seems to have further emboldened the regime in Tel Aviv to escalate its crimes. The regime is killing Palestinians on a daily basis. Israeli forces and settlers killed 319 Palestinians, including 71 minors, in 2021. That's the highest number since 2014. Also, 895 Palestinians were left homeless this year after 295 residential structures were demolished, the highest number since 2016. More than 600,000 Israelis live in over 230 settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of the West Bank and East Al-Quds. The UN Security Council has repeatedly condemned Israel's settlement activities. Israel also keeps hundreds of Palestinians in its prisons under the infamous administrative detention policy, which allows the regime to imprison Palestinians for years without charge or trial.
The options that are left for Palestinians are to continue unending resistance against Israel. This is really the only option. The more resistance they can do, the requirement here is to make the resistance so unlivable for the Israelis that the Israeli population will move away.
For more than four decades, the UN Security Council and General Assembly have stated in so many resolutions that construction of Israeli settlements in occupied territories are illegal and annexation of occupied Palestinian territory is unlawful. But Israel continues its activities with impunity, and that's mainly blamed on Washington's unabated support for Israel, whether financially, militarily, or even through brokering normalization ties with other states.
Thousands of Yemenis have staged mass protests across the country, including the capital Sana'a, on the National Day of Resilience, the day when the Saudi-led coalition began its aggression on Yemen. The demonstrators marked the seventh anniversary of the Saudi-led war on their country, denounced the aggression, and expressed their support for resistance against the Saudi-led invasion. The demonstrations followed a wave of retaliatory drone and missile attacks that hit targets across Saudi Arabia.
In response to the ongoing unjust siege on our country and our people, the Yemen Armed Forces underwent the third breaking siege operation through ballistic missiles and drones in the following manner. We targeted Aramco facilities in Jeddah and other locations in the capital of our Saudi enemy, Riyadh.
Facilities belonging to the Saudi state oil company, Aramco, were also hit in Jizan and Najran in the south. The Yemeni army also says it launched drone attacks against oil refineries in the east of the kingdom. According to the army, multiple vital targets in several other locations, including in Abha in Asir region, have also been hit by ballistic missiles. This is the Yemeni army's highest profile attack yet on the kingdom. The army vowed to continue the retaliatory military operations until Riyadh stops its years-long aggression and lifts its all-out siege on Yemen. Retaliatory missile and drone strikes against oil storage facilities in Saudi Arabia rekindled concerns over supply shortages as crude oil prices surged and broke the $120 level. The news added fuel to the already volatile oil market, shadowed by supply risks related to the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia has launched a series of attacks against Yemen, targeting the country's facilities in the provinces of Hodeidah and Sana'a, killing at least eight people. The coalition has hit oil facilities in Hodeidah. That violates a 2018 ceasefire deal that ended months of fighting in the city, which handles about 70% of Yemen's commercial and humanitarian imports. The air raids also hit the nearby Port Salif, also on the Red Sea. Saudi Arabia's warmongering policies in Yemen have so far killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis, injured tens of thousands, and displaced millions. However, the war has stopped well shy of its goals, as the Yemeni army is gaining momentum by striking a heavy blow against the Riyadh regime. It's high time Saudis realize that they are on the losing side of the war, one in which militarily they are defeated while endangering their jewel, Aramco.
Certainly, they are losing this war. The Yemeni government, the Yemeni military is growing in strength since the beginning of the war. They are developing their own weapons and also relying on their allies to provide them with weapons. This recent strike was very targeted, very calculated, and was a big surprise to Saudi Arabia.
Yemen Yemen has announced a 3-day unilateral ceasefire suspending all rocket and drone attacks against Saudi Arabia, affirming its readiness to turn the declaration into a permanent commitment.
We announced the cessation of offensive confrontations on all field fronts for a period of 3 days, and we affirm our readiness to turn this suspension into a final, continuous, and permanent commitment in the event that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia announces the withdrawal of all foreign forces of the coalition from our Yemeni lands and waters and a complete stop of its support to local militias in our country.
Mashat said Saudi Arabia must end its blockade on the Republic of Yemen once and for all. He said Yemen is also ready to perform a full prisoner exchange. He called on the UN Special Envoy for Yemen to take steps to prepare the agreements to carry out the exchanges. Following Mashat's declaration, the spokesman for Yemen's Ansarullah movement, Mohammed Abdel Salam, took to Twitter, urging Saudi Arabia to show a positive reaction to the announcement and prove that it's serious about peace. Meanwhile, the head of Yemen's negotiating team says Riyadh must prove its seriousness in response to Yemeni peace plan by responding to the ceasefire, lifting the siege, and withdrawing troops. The leader of the popular Ansarullah movement, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, has condemned the international community for remaining silent in the face of what he called Saudi crimes against the Yemeni people.
The United States should be supporting the people of Yemen in this war of aggression against them, but instead it is supporting the very powerful Saudi government. And it is, as you said, providing bombs, other weaponry, logistics, all kinds of aid to Saudi Arabia in their brutal and illegal war of aggression against the people of Yemen.
It has been around a month since the beginning of the Russia-Ukraine conflict, and the West has shown unabated support for Kyiv by denouncing Moscow's actions, providing military equipment for Ukraine, and the biased coverage of the war by Western media. Conversely, Western nations have seemingly forgotten that Yemen is the world's worst humanitarian crisis, one that the U.S. and several Western states have contributed to its making by providing arms and logistic support for the Saudi-led coalition.
Saudi Arabia's brutal war on Yemen has entered its eighth year. In March 2015, Saudi Arabia, in collaboration with a number of its allies, launched a bloody war against Yemen. The United States and several Western countries, including France and the UK, provided the Saudi-led coalition with arms and logistics support. The armaments that the U.S. has been providing the invading coalition have included precision ammunition, which the Saudi-led aggressors have been using amply against residential areas and other civilian targets. Soon after Riyadh began the war, the Pentagon started assigning a commando unit to the border between Saudi Arabia and Yemen to help the kingdom in the face of Yemeni defense forces' increasingly sophisticated retaliatory attacks. American military personnel have also been attending command and control centers on the Saudi and Emirati territories so they can best advise the countries about how to proceed with the war.
The Saudi regime, along with the UAE, backed by the United States and its allies in the region, including most notoriously Israel, continue to push for a wide-scale military operation against Yemen and the Yemeni people.
The objective was to return to power the former Riyadh-backed regime and to crush the popular Ansarullah resistance movement, which has been running state affairs in the absence of an effective government in Yemen. In 2014, the people of Yemen led a popular uprising against the Saudi-backed unpopular regime of Abdurrahman Mansur Hadi. As protests gripped the country, the Ansarullah resistance movement took control of the capital Sana'a, following a rapid advance south from their northern stronghold of Sada'a. The popular protests were against the incompetent and corrupt regime in Sana'a, backed by Riyadh. In a bid to crush the resistance and reinstall the Hadi regime, a Saudi-led coalition launched a ferocious bombing campaign on the neighboring Arab country barely 6 months later.
They are fighting against these imperialist forces that are coming to destroy Yemen. And so we see that continuously the Saudis, along with Sudanese mercenaries, the UAE, and other mercenary forces, backed by U.S. and Israel and NATO countries, continue to provide weaponry to bombard and kill indiscriminately civilians, to destroy civilian infrastructure.
The ferocious bombing campaign on Yemen and the subsequent war that was launched on the country has stopped well shy of all of its goals. But the war has killed tens of thousands of Yemenis and has turned the entire country into the scene of the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
The United States military-industrial complex, the national security state, along with its regional and international partners, continue to push for war, continue to push for the destruction of the Houthi forces, and want to see a Yemen that is under imperial domination and that is beholden to Washington, Tel Aviv.
The Saudi-led coalition has been preventing fuel shipments from reaching Yemen while looting the impoverished nation's resources. UN officials estimate that more than 3 million Yemenis have fled their homes due to the war. Nearly 300,000 people have also sought asylum in other countries. Internally displaced Yemenis often must cope with a lack of food and inadequate shelter. Many Yemenis who have not fled are also suffering, especially those in need of health care. The UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, describes the conflict as a living hell for children, with 1.8 million under the age of 5 suffering from severe malnutrition. The UN has said it needs billions of dollars to help the 17.2 million people. According to the UN Office for Humanitarian Coordination Affairs, more than 23 million out of the 31.9 million people in Yemen face hunger, disease, and other life-threatening risks as the country's basic services and economy are collapsing. The war has also devastated Yemen's infrastructure. Dozens of schools, hospitals, health facilities, factories and refineries have also been destroyed.
But we've seen also the Houthis gain the upper hand. In recent days, Yemeni forces have taken a wide swath of territory and just recently have targeted again Aramco oil facilities. So this war shows no sign of letting up, but it's clear that the Yemeni people will continue to fight and to struggle for their national liberation and for their right to self-determination.
However, Yemeni armed forces and allied popular committees have grown steadily in strength against the Saudi-led invaders and have left Riyadh and its allies bogged down in the country.
U.S. President Joe Biden has stirred up controversy after suggesting that his country could lead the world. Speaking at a business roundtable meeting, Joe Biden referred twice to, quote, a new world order. The phrase quickly became a trending topic on social media on Monday. On the surface, a new world order means a dramatic paradigm shift in international affairs and a change in the balance of power at the global scale. But what the U.S. president didn't consider when uttering those words was the connotation they carry with them. New World Order has for years been used by conspiracy theorists to mean a situation in which a secret cabal of governments take matters into their own hands to form a multinational totalitarian and oppressive regime. Which definition Biden might have been going for is beside the point. The main issue is that he took it upon himself to lead the world. The statement is a fundamental rejection of the world's multipolarity.
We have to always bear in mind that those who are in power, the hegemonic powers of the world, in particular the United States and their European allies, as well as the Zionist entity, they're always planning and always plotting, if you want to use that word, on how to further increase, how to maintain, how to strengthen, how to bolster the power that they already have.
How can the U.S. and its Western allies sideline their rivals, including Russia and China, that are superpowers? The West has been announcing new sanctions against Russia since it began its special military operation into Ukraine. Russia's financial and energy sectors have been under the West's crosshairs.
We are determined to continue to impose costs on Russia to bring about the end of this brutal war.
But Russia was already under sanctions before the conflict even started. This has had many speculating that the West might have been looking for an excuse to increase pressure on Moscow.
These people these people in power, and I'm talking specifically the United States here, they are trying to get rid of these hurdles, which they consider to be very bothersome impediments to their power projection. So the United States at this moment is trying to completely get rid of the national sovereign powers that still exist in the world. For example, Russia, China, Iran, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, Venezuela, Cuba, you know, all sorts of countries that are refusing to bow down and to accept the globalist world order. These countries are now in particular being targeted.
But such pressure would backfire at those imposing them too. The most basic example is the EU's reliance on Russian energy. At a time when the bloc faces an energy crisis and soaring consumer prices, sanctioning a major producer of gas, oil, and wheat doesn't seem like a sound plan. Russia isn't sitting idly by. Moscow has been planning initiatives to cushion the blow of sanctions on its economy. President Vladimir Putin announced this week that his country has drawn up a list of, quote, unfriendly countries that need to pay for their energy purchases from Russia in rubles. U.S. President Joe Biden entered the Oval Office, promising to bring back diplomacy and to reverse his predecessor's misguided policies. 14 months into his presidency, however, he is following in the footsteps of the Donald Trump administration. How much longer will it take for the U.S. to realize that the unipolar world is no more?
Hello.
Happy New Year.
Bye-bye. We congratulate all Iranians and Persian-speaking peoples of the world on the occasion of Nowruz.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 3, 2016 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of 27th anniversary of Imam Khomeini's passing. The speech was delivered at Imam Khomeini's shrine in Tehran, Iran.
We have many small and big enemies. We have small and cruel enemies as well. But the main enmity comes from America and from England. England is truly wicked. England has shown enmity towards us in the past, in the early Pahlavi era, in the revolutionary era, and after the victory of the revolution, and in the present time. England has always shown enmity towards us. Now, too, the propaganda apparatus of the Anglican government has published some so-called documents against Imam Rahmatullah Alayh. On the occasion of his demise anniversary, it publishes a document against our magnanimous, pure and pristine Imam, Rahmatullah Alayh. From where did they bring the document? They found it among American documents. Well, does America, that brought down a passenger plane with 300 Iranian lives on board, have any scruples about faking documents? The enmity of Britain is carried out like so. Another main portion of enmity comes from the vile and cancerous Zionist regime. These are our leading enemies.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
We must undertend this enemy, and we should show diligence in the face of his plots. Even if they give us an economic prescription, we should be cautious when taking it. It is comparable to when an enemy gives you a pill and advises you to take it for some disease. You exercise caution because it is possible that the pill is toxic. The political and economic prescriptions of the enemy should receive careful attention. Vigilance in the face of the enemy should be practiced like this. Naturally, when this vigilance exists, we will not follow him. As I said before, refusal to follow the enemy is a great jihad. This is the fourth criterion. The fifth and last criterion is religious and political piety, which is different from individual piety. Of course, individual piety is necessary as well. One kind of piety is individual piety, in which we avoid sins and we preserve ourselves. Save yourselves and your families from a fire whose fuel is men and stones. The Holy Quran, chapter 66, verse 6.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me. Through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me.
In the limelight.
A Maryland judge on Friday, 25th of March, blocked the state's new congressional map, which could have shut Republicans out of the state's delegation, ruling that it unfairly benefits Democrats. We'll prepare for you an article written by Ethan Cohen. The piece is titled, Maryland Judge Rules Democratic Drawn Electoral Map is Unconstitutional. The article has been published by the Associated Press news agency. A Maryland judge ruled on Friday, 25th of March, that the state's new congressional map is unconstitutional, the first map by a Democratic-controlled state legislature to be struck down by a court of law this redistricting cycle. So far, courts have intervened to block maps they found to be GOP gerrymanders in North Carolina, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, infuriating Republicans and leading conservatives to push for the U.S. Supreme Court to limit the power of state courts to overturn maps drawn by state legislatures. Judge Lynn Battaglia issued the ruling after a trial recently in which Republican lawmakers contended that Maryland's congressional map, approved by the General Assembly in December, violates the Constitution by drawing districts that favor Democrats who control the legislature. Judge Battaglia wrote, "The limitation of the undue extension of power by any branch of government must be exercised to ensure that the will of the people is heard, no matter under which political placard those governing reside. The 2021 congressional plan is unconstitutional and subverts that will of those governed. Judge Battaglia added that she was entering a judgment in favor of the plaintiffs to reject the map and permanently enjoining its operation and giving the General Assembly an opportunity to develop a new congressional plan that is constitutional. Judge Battaglia has a long history in Maryland's judiciary. She served as a member of the state's highest court from 2001 to 2016. She served as Maryland's U.S. Attorney from 1993 to 2001. She also was chief of staff to the former Maryland Senator Barbara Mikulski, a Democrat, from 1991 to 1993. An appeal by the state is almost certain. Raquel Coombs, a spokeswoman for the Attorney General, said the office was reviewing the decision. In Maryland, where registered Democrats outnumber Republicans 2-1 and Democrats hold a strong majority in both chambers of legislature, the GOP has long criticized the map as one of the most gerrymandered in the country. Doug Mayer, a spokesman for Fair Maps Maryland, said, "Judge Battaglia's ruling confirms what we have all known for years. Maryland is ground zero for gerrymandering. Our districts and political reality reek of it, and there is abundant proof that it is occurring." He added, "Marylanders had been fighting for free and fair elections for decades, and for the first time in our state's shameful history of gerrymandering, we are at the precipice of ending it." The ruling comes under the unusual circumstances of Maryland having a Republican governor in a redistricting year, Governor Larry Hogan, who has long sought reforms to the way the state draws political boundaries, created a separate commission to draw maps for the state's congressional seats and state legislative districts in hopes of taking politicians out of the process of drawing districts. Governor Larry Hogan submitted the maps to the General Assembly, but the legislature moved forward with maps approved by a separate panel that included top legislative leadership, including 4 Democrats and 2 Republicans. Governor Larry Hogan vetoed the map approved by the legislature in December, saying it made a mockery of our democracy. After the judge's ruling, the governor called on lawmakers to approve the map submitted by the commission he supported. Maryland Governor Larry Hogan said in a statement, "I call on the General Assembly to immediately pass the Independent Citizens Redistricting Commission maps that were written with accountability and transparency. This is a historic milestone in our fight to clean up the political process in our state and ensure that the voices of the people are the elected to serve are finally heard." If the case comes before the Maryland Court of Appeals, the state's highest court, it will be considered by a panel on which all but one of the serving judges was appointed by Governor Larry Hogan. Chief Justice Joseph Getty recently delayed the state's primary elections from 28th of June to 19th of July, as courts weigh challenges to the state's new legislative map as well as the congressional map. At a recent trial, a witness from Maryland Republicans testified that partisan considerations had taken over when Democrats drew the map. Democrats currently hold a 7-1 advantage over the GOP in the state's 8 U.S. House seats. The new map made the district held by lone Republican Representative Andy Harris more competitive for a Democrat to potentially win. Sean Trend, an elections analyst at Real Clear Politics, testified as a witness for Republicans at recent trial that Democrats are almost guaranteed to have 7 districts and have a great shot at winning the 8th district. The trial involved two lawsuits. One was brought by a group of Republican state lawmakers backed by Fairmaps Maryland. The other was brought by the national conservative activist group Judicial Watch.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
In the aftermath of Yemen's blistering retaliatory strike on Saudi Arabia's Aramco oil facilities, crude oil prices shot up by over $120 a barrel. Yemen's military spokesperson revealed that the operation had been carried out in response to continued Saudi-led aggression.
Yemen will not hesitate to widen its military operation until the end of the aggression and breaking of the siege. Allah is witness to what we say.
With the threat of future attacks looming, many fear that Saudi's seemingly endless war on Yemen could negatively contribute to economic instability in Europe.
Now we are seeing it's affecting the pounds and the pennies. It's not just Britain. Look at the price of the gasoline and petrol in the United States, in Germany, everywhere else. Everything is connected, you know, and I think the fact of the matter is today's world, we can't commit these sort of atrocities on one side and think it's not going to come and bite us back later on. And now we are seeing very clear indication of direct impact on our pounds and pennies.
With the relationship between Russia and the West continuing to crumble, Riyadh hopes that it can use this opportunity and Europe's desperate need to replace Russian oil to its own advantage. However, with Yemen's ability to hit key Saudi oil infrastructure at will, serious questions are being raised about the reliability of Saudi as an oil-producing partner. Robert Carter, London.
Rights activists and families of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli prisons held a sit-in inside the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Gaza. They protested Tel Aviv's inhumane treatment of thousands of Palestinian political prisoners in Israeli jails. Their show of solidarity comes as around 500 administrative detainees have been refusing to show up for their military court hearings for almost 3 months. Administrative detainees are incarcerated based on secret evidence, without charge or trial, for long periods of time.
This step by Palestinian administrative detainees is continue for around 86 days, protesting the administrative detention. And they insist to continue this step until they attain their demand of stopping or halting this illegal detention.
Palestinian prisoners, including women and children, as well as elderly prisoners, are kept in 24 Israeli jails and detention centers and are subjected to torture and psychological pressures by the Israeli prison authorities.
Today we are here to support the prisoners. Prisoners is our hero. We are to support prisoners and their families. We are continuing to support them in all ways.
Palestinian prisoners are denied basic human rights as Tel Aviv continues to violate international laws and norms regarding the treatment of prisoners.
We are here to support our prisoners. They are facing suffering in Israel and their family, and to tell Red Cross to defend our prisoners. They are suffering with administrative detention and hunger strike.
Families of the prisoners say they will continue their weekly sit-ins until all Palestinian prisoners are set free.
People here consider Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails as political prisoners and freedom fighters. Israel currently incarcerates around 5,000 Palestinians. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Cartoons often have the power, by drawing attention quickly and getting straight to the point, to uncover deceit and deliver uncomfortable, shocking messages. In a span of over 25 years since the early 60s, late Palestinian cartoonist Naji al-Ali produced over 40,000 drawings and several books of cartoons, raising awareness on the Palestinian plight at the hands of Israeli settlers and harshly criticizing Arab regimes and the U.S. imperialistic policies. Today, a book containing tens of cartoons by al-Ali has been published for the first time in Italy. Naji al-Ali's most famous character is Andala, a 10-year-old barefoot child dressed in ragged clothes. The boy, always drawn from behind while watching all the bad that is happening on Earth, has over time become a symbol of the Palestinian resistance, giving voice to the poor and oppressed. This year marks the 35th anniversary of the assassination of Andala's creator Naji al-Ali, as he was murdered outside a newspaper office in the UK in 1987. 5 years ago, London's police department reopened its investigation into the unsolved murder of the Palestinian political cartoonist.
Naji al-Ali rappresentato.
Naji al-Ali's work was for a long time reflective of the Palestinian cause. His cartoons were very critical of everybody involved in the Palestinian plight. Andala means bitter in Arabic and well represents the struggle of the Palestinians. The fact that the boy was drawn from behind meant that everybody, including the Arabic world, had turned their back to Palestine. Al-Ali's assassination was plotted by dark powers, certainly close to the Mossad.
Naji al-Ali's book was recently launched in Naples. It will also be presented in several other Italian cities, including Rome, Genoa, and Bologna. Max Civili, Rome.
On the banks of Kashmir's famous Dal Lake, surrounded by the majestic Zabarwan mountain range, Asia's largest tulip garden opens for visitors. 1.5 million flowers of 68 varieties have vibrantly colored the earth.
This is heaven and this place is beyond imagination. After facing lockdown for 2 years, this place is a treat.
Whatever is said in the media and shown is not the truth. The truth is, it is the most secure place to visit.
Kashmir is witnessing bumper tourist season this spring after COVID-19 pandemic lockdown. Administration as well as people expect a bumper tourist season.
We are trying our best, and this year we are lucky in terms of early spring, so that people of Kashmir will have an economic boost.
Following the coronavirus pandemic, the tourists stopped visiting Kashmir, and last 2 years, Kashmir's economy faced a major setback.
Tourism is our backbone of our economy. The money they pump in our economy is manifold for our economy. So that's why our tourist, this tulip garden, it gives impetus to our tourist season. It prepones our tourist season. We have seen the initial response from tourists, particularly from outside UT. We are hoping that this season will be a great season for our tourism sector.
To reclaim the fractured economy, Kashmir's administration has organized a tulip festival to attract more tourists and locals so that the lockdown impact vanishes slowly to conflict-wrecked Kashmir.
After 2.5 years of continued closure due to COVID-19 pandemic, the opening of this garden has brought delight to the people of Kashmir, who for decades have suffered political instability and turmoil. Opening of such spaces help boost morale and is a good start to a fresh year. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Following one of the largest retaliatory attacks by the Yemeni army against Aramco facilities across Saudi Arabia, thousands of Yemenis filled the streets of Yemen's capital Sana'a and other major cities to mark the National Day of Resilience.
The Yemeni people are free. 7 years of crime have passed against us, but this has been matched by 7 years of steadfastness, freedom, and defeat of the enemy. The Yemeni army has manufactured weapons, including ballistic missiles and drones, and this is by the grace of God. And as Mr. Abdul Malik al-Houthi said, now a new phase of confrontation with the Saudi enemy will begin. Our big gathering today is to confirm that we will remain steadfast until we win and expel the occupier.
The protesters expressed their support for the army's recent aerial operations, saying the Saudis only understand the language of force and it is a legitimate right, as it is self-defense against Riyadh's war and siege.
All the Yemeni people are supporting the operations which has been against the Saudi facilities, economic and facilities, and also military facilities. We are revenging violations have been committed against the Yemeni people since March 2015, and we are very sure that we are now in the year of victory.
On Friday, the Yemeni army launched fresh attacks against several targets in Saudi Arabia. The attacks caused a heavy blow to Aramco's facilities in Jeddah, Jazan and Najran, as well as Ras Tanura and Rabigh refineries. The Yemeni army said it has also targeted vital sites in Riyadh with ballistic missiles.
People here say the 8th year of the war will be different, as the Yemeni army has already proven that it is capable of hitting Saudi targets, including its oil facilities. The Yemenis believe that Riyadh will eventually have to consider a political solution, at least to protect its oil giant Aramco in the face of Yemeni attacks. Avlatif Al-Washali, Sana.
France goes to the polls in just 2 weeks in an election marked by major disinterest and discontent over a lack of discussion on worsening domestic issues. Abstention is expected to reach 30%. The last time so few voters turned out was 2002, when the far-right National Front shockingly made it to the second round. Many wonder if this election, the surging left may stage a similar surprise, with Jean-Luc Mélenchon now approaching the far-right's Marine Le Pen in the battle to make it past the first round. The so-called bourgeois bloc of voters is highly motivated to win re-election for Emmanuel Macron, so he seems certain to make it to the final round. He has avoided debates and public appearances, preferring to focus on Ukraine, as his tenure has been marked by a record number of corruption scandals, economic inequality, and unprecedented political repression. In 2017, the two mainstream political parties, dogged by corruption scandals, were ousted for the first time since Charles de Gaulle. In 2012, optimism was sky high that François Hollande was going to end austerity and stand up to Berlin and Brussels. But in this election, France, a rare Western country known for high levels of political engagement, appears to be exhausted by politics. A vast and intimidating police presence at demonstrations won't encourage political gatherings either.
Everyone here can feel the intimidation towards the yellow vests. Look at how cops are surrounding us before we even start. We're the only protesters who get treated like this, except for neo-Nazi rallies. But we aren't neo-Nazis or a political party. We're simply the people.
Unions have just pulled out their big gun, an unlimited strike for Paris public transport. That strike has confusingly been stopped after just 1 day, perhaps showing that France remains in a state of confusion even so close to the election.
France has only just ended its coronavirus restrictions, and the lack of political interest appears to show that the country hasn't really gotten back to normal. Western polls have been notoriously inaccurate, however, and sky-high inflation may play a crucial part when voters decide about the next 5 years. Rahman Mazahiri, Paris.
In yet another act of Israeli aggression against the Palestinians of Gaza, Israeli planes sprayed toxic chemicals on the eastern perimeter of the coastal enclave. Israeli crop duster planes sprayed herbicides at least twice this week on Gaza farming areas. The Israeli regime regularly sprays Palestinian agricultural lands near the so-called buffer zone with dangerous substances which destroy the crops. For more than a decade, Israeli planes sprayed Gaza's farmlands several times a year, destroying various crops.
The Israelis spread herbicides to the farmers' land beside the border in order to prevent them to plant in their land, to push the farmers out of their land and leave their land with